Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out what a stringent new EPA regulation that was proposed last week would mean for the Valley's air. It's all part of an effort to reduce the amount of ozone pollution in our skies. Some are calling it a much-needed remedy that would save thousands of lives. Others say it's simply not practical. We'll talk to the Valley's top air pollution officer and find out what it means for those of us living in one of the dirtiest places in the nation. We'll also get a preview of a new nature preserve that's set to open to the public in Tulare County, the Blue Oak Preserve near Springville, when we talk to representatives of the Sequoia Riverlands Trust. But first, we turn our attention to immigration. Beginning January 2nd, undocumented Californians can apply for driver licenses in the state. 1.4 million people are expected to apply for AB 60 licenses over the next few years. From Sacramento, Katie Orr reports on how preparations are going.
There's a mix of excitement and distrust in immigrant communities as the state prepares to start issuing licenses. Pedro Rios is with American Friends Service Committee in San Diego, which supports immigrant-led organizations. He says undocumented immigrants are nervous about how they'll be treated by law enforcement, but he says they're also looking forward to having the licenses.
The AB 60 license would be something that would provide them a nice protection to be able to go to work, to go to school, to take their kids to the hospital or a clinic if they need to.
Jessica Gonzalez is with the California Department of Motor Vehicles. She says staff combed through public comments to make sure the community was satisfied with the process and requirements for getting a license.
Because the whole point of AB 60 is so that our roads are safer, that people know the rules of the road, that they're licensed, that if they own a vehicle, that they're insured. So we really had to really go through every comment and find out, are people really going to be able to obtain a driver license under AB 60?
Gonzalez says anyone who can't obtain the necessary documents can go through an identity verification interview with the DMV so they can apply. In Sacramento, I'm Katie Orr.
You're listening to Valley Edition. President Obama's recent announcement that he will take new executive action on undocumented immigrants is already reverberating throughout the Valley's large immigrant communities. The president's executive order would affect around 4 million people who entered the country illegally before 2010 and have children who are either U.S. citizens or have green cards. It's a similar order to the one the president issued in 2012 regarding children who were brought to the country illegally by their parents, and that those who meet the requirements would be protected from deportations and could obtain work permits. Joining us now to talk more about what this means is law professor Jessica Smith-Bobadilla of the San Joaquin College of Law. Professor Smith-Bobadilla, welcome.
Thank you.
You work on immigration law. Not only do you teach this, but you practice it on a regular basis. In that last report about the driver's license bill and how that's being implemented, Katie Orr said in the community there's a mix of excitement and distrust. Is that the same for the immigrant community in regards to the president's latest announcement?
Yes, I think that is accurate. There's a lot of enthusiasm that finally there's a reprieve from deportation for a lot of working families, including many in our valley. But at the same time, there's somewhat of a distrust as to whether this is something that would be long-lasting or nearly permanent, even though it's clear that it's not a permanent solution. Or whether it's something that people should be a little cautious about pursuing.
So what are the sort of, what's the terrain of this particular issue as you're dealing with it in the real world? Right now, as I understand it, some things we know, some things we don't know, but let's talk about the knowns right now. What do we know about how this is actually going to play out?
So we know that the majority of the announcement that President Obama made on November 20th will enter into effect 180 days after. So that would mean that the parents of U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents that have been here 5 years, that have clean records, basically, could apply for a stay of deportation and a work permit 6 months, basically, after the November 20th announcement. There was also, with the president's announcement, some tweaks to some other existing programs. There was a little bit of the expansion of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, and that will enter into effect a little sooner. And there were also some changes to the employment-based immigration structure with regard to technical visas and some other things of that nature.
Now, the White House has said that around 4 million people would be affected by the largest of these different categories covered under this latest order, the one in regarding those who have children children who are born here in the U.S. or minors who have green cards. When it comes to that 4 million number, though, is that that's the number of people who would actually potentially be eligible. In real terms, though, it might not necessarily be 4 million people applying for this, as I understand it, because there's other hoops that people have to jump through.
That's correct. And it's important for people to understand that while there's kind of a short list of requirements that this executive action announced, that all immigration programs, whether they're from the executive or from the legislative branch, don't exist in a vacuum. So, for example, when we're advising clients through the New American Legal Clinic or through my private practice, we always advise that you need to investigate your whole history, because even though it seems like the requirements are simple, if someone previously was deported or had a court case that they had pursued in immigration court that didn't work out, that could impact whether or not they should pursue this executive action option.
And there's also a provision in the president's executive action that requires residents to prove they've had continual residence here in the U.S. since 2010, essentially. Is that something that's going to be a challenge for many people who are here undocumented? Because keeping records, those are the sorts of things that in some cases people don't have.
It is. It is and it isn't. One of the, I think, misconceptions about the undocumented is that they don't pay taxes. And really, the majority do pay taxes, federal taxes, with an individual taxpayer ID number. So many people will be covered with that type of a proof that they can present. There are probably many, however, women that are taking care of these U.S. citizen and permanent resident children that might not have these same forms of objective proof available. And one thing that USCIS or the Department of Homeland Security has always emphasized with all programs and all forms of proof is that they don't want self-serving evidence. Basically, they don't want a letter from the neighbor or your aunt. They want bank statements. They want federal tax records. They want check stubs, things that prove presence that wouldn't be easy to alter or for people to get confused about the dates, even if they're well-intentioned. They want objective forms of proof with the person's name and a date stamped on that document.
Now, the president's latest action comes after his prior executive order on immigration from August, I believe it was, of 2012, regarding the DACA people, the quote-unquote dreamers. These are people who came to this country as minors. Their parents brought them here. They've grown up here. This new order makes some changes to that in terms of the eligibility for that, but beyond this, the nuts and bolts of what the president's announcement last month would affect DACA, what have we learned from that program over the past 2 years? How has it been implemented? How has it worked in real life out in communities like here
right.
in Kern County and Fresno County?
Right. So the first announcement for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals was actually June 15th of 2012. And the program has, in many regards, been a success. Lots of young people in our valley and throughout the country have been able to progress with their education, have been able, in the case of many of my clients, many of whom are Fresno State alumni, have been able to pursue very advanced opportunities in employment, including one young woman who's working in New York, who was my client, who's a Fresno State alumni, and has traveled abroad for her job on the permission that she's been granted now. Another young man who is in Southern California and working in political related areas now that he has work authorization. So there's a lot of people that have become success stories. And then there's just a lot of average students that aren't at a graduate or undergraduate level yet that I think have been encouraged to take that next step, to take the SAT, because now they have a work permit and they have a path to continue their education.
If you just joined us in Valley Edition, we're talking to Jessica Smith-Bobadilla of the San Joaquin College of Law in Fresno. She's also a local immigration attorney. And I'd like to expand the conversation now to Vicente Sanchez Ventura. He is the head consul of the Mexican consulate in Fresno. Consul Sanchez Ventura, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning, and I have the pleasure to be here with you this morning.
Yes, I understand that your consulate has also done some things in response to the president's latest executive order. What's happening in terms of your presence in the Valley?
Well, thanks to this announcement, it's a great opportunity for many Mexicans who are living in the United States and in California. California is one of the states that the Mexican population is very high. Then with this amount of people that we have here, we are 10 consulates in California. We have the consular network system is integrated by 50 consulates in the United States and just 10 in California. It explains how it's important for us, the Mexican community who live here. Well, with this announcement, we are ready to work serving the community. It's time to first give the appropriate information that they need, because many people, they understand something about this immigration announcement, but just a few of them know exactly what is happening. Well, this is the responsibility of the consular offices to give the information, to collaborate with different nonprofits, leaders, or different attorneys who are working with us for a long time, in order to together give this information. We understand that many people will take advantage of this situation with abuses and some fraudulent topics for our community. Well, this is something that we need to work against this, because now the information, it's a key issue here.
You mentioned the issue of fraud. Not only is that a concern for people maybe looking to take advantage of the system, but also is there a concern about fraud for people who are trying to help others navigate this system? Jessica, this is a big change, and we've heard in the past about unscrupulous people who take advantage of immigrants who are in a situation where they don't have a lot of power, or maybe don't know exactly what the system involves. Have you seen that in the past, and is that a concern in the future?
Definitely, yes. I'm living in different states here in the United States. It's the same problem. Different people who are taking the advantage about DACA or years ago with some migratory reforms. It's essential the work that we have against these people, but we can do this just alone. That's why we have a comprehensive strategy to work together with this collaboration with lawyers, nonprofits, as I said. But the topic is give the simple information to the community through the media, through the social media, through the contact person to person. And in our office, we receive every day 300 people daily. Yes, we are distributing information through different brochures or simple pages with information, essential information. It is something that we are working in English and in Spanish, because many of them are integrated now to the United States, and many are speaking Spanish, but mainly in English in some cases. That's why we are interested to work here with this strategy. But how we can respond to the community? Well, we're going to extend hours of services. We're going to work giving services to the mobile through the program that we call Mobile Consulate, through this program, we are visiting different cities in the Central Valley. Every day we are serving people in Potterville, in Madera, etc. And we receive a lot, around 200 people serving, 300 people in our office. We are attending 500 people at least.
Turning back to Professor Smith-Bobadilla, this is not a new law. That's been pretty clear in the media coverage of this. This is an executive order by the president, one also that he or another president could rescind just as easily as he issued it. Is that a concern amongst those who are potentially eligible for this program? And could that, do you think, maybe keep some people from taking advantage of it, knowing that it could just as easily go away?
It is a concern among the community, and it's very difficult because technically it could be rescinded or modified or reversed in some way by another administration. It's very difficult for us to advise people that that's impossible because it's not. Now, there is a history of executive action on immigration going back into U.S. history, and recently, in recent U.S. history, President Reagan was behind the amnesty program, which legalized many people in our valley. And also, President H.W. Bush also had signed an executive order that also had some legalization program that was implemented by that executive order. So those haven't been reversed by any later president. So if history repeats itself, then the executive order wouldn't be reversed. But it is a possibility. This is a hot button issue. It's not becoming less of a hot button political issue in the United States.
In the minute or so we have less before we go, what is the takeaway? What is the next step here? What are your biggest concerns moving forward?
Well, I think that, we are hopeful that through our work with the consulate and through our work with the law school, I run a nonprofit called the New American Legal Clinic at San Joaquin College of Law, that we can together and with other community partners combat the fraud, help as many people that are eligible apply for these benefits, and help families kind of have a little bit of relief from the anxiety that they faced just trying to get to work every day and worrying that maybe they wouldn't be here tomorrow to take their kids to school. I think that this helps a lot of people that are very hardworking families in our valley.
And Consul Sanchez Ventura, your consulate, are you prepared for this onslaught of people that's coming in just a few days?
Yes, we are ready. We have different meetings with the rest of my colleagues in California. This weekend we're going to discuss our strategy. But essentially, we're going to extend hours of service. We're going to prepare a campaign of information to the community. We're going to serve more people that we are serving daily. This is more or less the strategy. And essentially, working against fraud. This is another topic that is part of this strategy.
We've been talking with the head consul of the Mexican Consulate in Fresno, Vicente Sanchez Ventura, and Jessica Smith-Bobadilla of the San Joaquin Valley College of Law and the New American Legal Clinic at the law school. Stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and find out what's going on with this storm that is buffeting the San Joaquin Valley. We'll talk to a representative of the National Weather Service in Sanger in just a moment here on Valley Edition.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The vaquita is a small porpoise that looks a little like a dolphin. It's one of the most endangered animals on the planet. Some estimate it may be extinct within 3 years. So environmentalists are battling against Mexican drug cartels and Chinese fishermen to try to save it. But is it too late? That story next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now starts this morning at 11 on Valley Public Radio.
Hi, this is David Green. While most of you are still sleeping, I am spending my overnights right here at NPR getting ready to host Morning Edition. Usually, I'm touching base with reporters and editors around the world, writing scripts or begging for more coffee. What makes all of that possible? Well, it could be your car. That's right, the car you're driving could help pay for the next great story you hear on Morning Edition. Turn your car into the programs you love.
Visit kvpr.org for more information on the vehicle donation program.
You're listening to Valley Edition. There was a bit of good news Monday in the horror story that is California's ongoing drought. State water officials released their first forecast for water deliveries over the next year, and the initial prediction for deliveries will meet 10% of the overall demand. That may sound like a terrible projection, but it's actually twice what the initial outlook was at this time last year. That situation could improve if more winter storms bring rain and snow to the region. And, of course, we're seeing a little of that, at least in the rain department in Central California today. Joining us now on the phone to tell us more about this latest storm moving through the valley is Gary Sanger of the National Weather Service in Hanford. Mr. Sanger, welcome.
I'm glad to be able to talk to you and tell the people about the current storm.
It's a very exciting time. It seems like it's been a while since we've had a storm quite like this. This is a warm one, though. Snow level around 8,000 feet. Characterize what we're experiencing in the valley today.
Now we have a low-pressure system that's off the Northern California coast, and it's tapping into some subtropical moisture. It's a warm air mass. So that's why we're having the very high snow levels, as you mentioned, around 8,000 feet. We're seeing some south winds at the south end of the valley where it's already in the mid-60s, and even one spot reported a 70-degree temperature so far. And in terms of rainfall, through 9 a.m., Fresno had 1,600ths of an inch of rain, and of course it's still falling, so we're looking for the possibility of a little over an inch storm total through Wednesday night.
And is that the same for Kern County and those areas, about overall looking at the same amount of rainfall projected?
Looking for a little bit less rain down south. The south winds coming through the passes is a drying wind, so not as much rain is going to fall initially. But we're looking at maybe half to three-quarters of an inch in Kern County in the valley floor and up to an inch and a quarter in the Kern River Valley and Lake Isabella area, and maybe up to 2.5 inches in the higher elevations of the Paiutes and the Southern Sierra.
Now, given that this is a warm storm, does that present some problems in terms of the potential for flooding?
It's not going to be so much the fact that it's a warm storm as just the rain rates. It hasn't been hardly any rain for several months, as you know. So the burn scurries have not had a chance to get any vegetation to hold the soil in place. So if we do get a heavy rain on any of the burn scurries, there's going to be potential for mud and debris flows, flash flooding. And we do have flash flood watches out for the burn scour areas, both in Kern County and up by Yosemite.
And I understand for people who are traveling south on Highway 99 and Interstate 5, well, specifically Interstate 5, going over the Grapevine, that you have a high wind warning there?
That's correct. We're seeing wind gusts still about 55 miles an hour at the base of the Grapevine, and near the crest of the Grapevine, one of our stations is reporting gusts as high as 66 miles an hour.
Wow. Well, definitely take caution if you're in the southern part of our listening area and going to Southern California over the Grapevine today. Now, here's the big question. This storm plays out this week. Is there anything coming behind it that we might be able to see coming later this month?
We do have a weak system that's going to move to Northern California on Saturday. It's going to barely clip our area. It's not going to bring much in the way of rain. And after that, it's going to be dry with high pressure for next week. So we're going to see, unfortunately, the return of the Thule fog.
Well, we'll enjoy the rain while we have it and hope that there's more to come. Gary Sanger of the National Weather Service joining us today on Valley Edition. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome, sir.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and talk about the new regulations that were announced last week by the U.S. EPA, pending regulations that would make the ozone emissions in the valley potentially an even higher bar to reach. We'll talk to Syed Sedreddin of the Valley Air District in just a moment on Valley Edition. Last week, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency unveiled a plan that would set a more stringent rule for the amount of ozone pollution in the air. The proposal is based on new research on the health effects of ozone pollution. In fact, the EPA says that if it's adopted, the new rule could prevent as many as 4,300 premature deaths nationwide in the next decade. But it has been met with controversy. Republicans and business groups say the positive health benefits are actually outweighed by the cost of complying with the new rules. Some have gone so far as to call it nearly impossible. Of course, the San Joaquin Valley has struggled to meet the current 8-hour standard for years. In fact, the valley is already what's called an extreme non-attainment zone. And more new stringent rules make reaching compliance even tougher. So what's all this mean for you and your family? Our guest now is Syed Sedreddin, the Executive Director of the Valley Air District. Mr. Sedreddin, welcome.
Hi, good morning. Good to be with you.
What kind of health toll does the ozone pollution we have in the valley have on our lives right now? Let's talk about the health effects before we talk about what this potential regulation would mean.
Well, there are two pollutants in San Joaquin Valley that we have difficulties with, one being particulate matter, the fine particles during winter time, and then the ozone problem is a summertime phenomenon. Particulate matter relative to ozone has a lot more impact on premature deaths and health impact with some of those fine particles that are carcinogenic and also have a lot of cardiovascular impact on our bodies. Ozone relatively has less impact on public health, but it's still a significant irritant to our system, respiratory system, and there are various studies that are emerging that show the health impact might be even worse than what we had thought before. But it's a significant health impact to Valley residents. But we've made a lot of progress over the years, and we're on the right track with that.
So we're talking about asthma and other respiratory diseases. Is that correct?
It's an irritant to your lung. It's a corrosive chemical that impacts your immune system and your lung system. Again, not as much as fine particles do, but still in a significant way when you are exposed to high concentrations of ozone on a prolonged period of time.
So right now the current standard that's in place is 75 parts per billion. The new standard could be as low as 60 parts per billion. It could be 65. It could be 70. That's still to be determined. But can you give me an idea of what that means in real terms? What are we talking about when we talk about these different numbers? Is there is there something you can tell us to make that more realistic in terms for a non-scientist?
That's a great question, because there has been a lot of cursory characterization of what this new standard means, both by EPA and in the media. And if you look at the San Joaquin Valley situation, what is generally reported as a consequence of this new standard may not really be applicable here. You eloquently mentioned the difficulties that we have in meeting the current standard. So in San Joaquin Valley and South Coast, where we have mature programs already in place, and we're still trying to find measures to meet the current standard, you're not going to really see any improvements or any added reductions or expedited reductions in emissions, because this new standard is not published. It sets a very difficult target for us to meet in the next 20 to 30 years. But in the next 10 years, 20 years, while we're still looking for measures to meet the current standard, this new action by EPA really doesn't move the ball with regard to getting more reductions or sooner reductions anytime soon in San Joaquin Valley and in South Coast. And that's part of some of the issues that we have with the implementation phase of these federal regulations, which cause confusion for the public and a lot of bureaucratic red tape for the businesses and agencies that have to comply with these regulations.
So what happens when a region isn't able to meet these rules, whether we're talking about the old ones or the new ones? Clearly, the new one, once published and implemented, is even a higher bar. But let's set that aside for now. What happens if the air district cannot meet the EPA standard?
Well, you know, aside from the health consequences, of course, that, you know, we would continue to suffer with continued exposure to those pollutants, just looking at it strictly from a legal perspective, under the Federal Cleaner Act, there are a number of sanctions or penalties that the region would face, beginning with making it more difficult for new businesses, new employers to be able to locate in San Joaquin Valley, because it does raise the cost of what it takes to get a permit for a new facility. And it also then, in a few months after that first sanction, the next sanction that would kick in is loss of billions of dollars annually in federal funding for transportation funding to the valley, which has quite a significant economic impact on the valley. And then ultimately, we would end up in the situation that we are facing right now with the very old one-hour ozone standard, where we had to pay a non-attainment penalty fee to the tune of $30 million a year by valley residents in the form of DMV fees that they have to pay.
And those fees then go to help clean up the air. They're not just punitive fees, but help to also clean the valley skies. I know your agency is not responsible for all pollution sources or doesn't have the power to regulate all pollution sources, but let's set aside that issue of jurisdiction for a moment. And this, in a hypothetical world where you have complete control over the entire, everything that happens, do we know what would be necessary to the changes that would be required in a place like the San Joaquin Valley to meet something like this new standard if it were actually implemented? What would be necessary aside from the realities of the way that the real world really works?
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, in San Joaquin Valley, just to meet the current standard, since 1980, we have reduced air pollution from valley businesses by over 80%, to the point that today 80% of our air pollution is coming from mobile sources, as we call them, cars, trucks, rail, locomotives, and things like that, and 20% comes from valley businesses that are already regulated by some of the toughest regulations in the nation. Now, what our analysis shows to meet the current standard of 75 parts per billion, we need to reduce valley's air pollution by another 75% on top of the 80% that we've already reduced it. And then, depending on where EPA ultimately ends up in setting the new standard, which is, you know, 60 to 70 parts per billion, we essentially have to get to a point where we either ban fossil fuel combustion or find a technology where you can still use fossil fuel with zero emissions, which is part of the issue that we have with how the Clean Air Act currently works. We don't believe it gives us enough time to get there with the timelines that are provided in the formulas that are already in the Clean Air Act. But basically, we need to go to zero emissions because the new standard encroaches on the background ozone concentrations that we see in the valley, even absent any man-made pollution. So to get there, we need the infrastructure for using zero emissions vehicles and other devices that currently use fossil fuel combustion, and also the technology and also the fleet turnover to get there. In San Joaquin Valley and South Coast, the deadline that is now set or will be set for this new standard is 2037 or 35-37 timeline, and that, even though it's like some 20 years away, if you really look at the enormous magnitude of the changes that have to happen, is very difficult, if not impossible, to actually be able to get there by that timeline.
So how far are we right now away from meeting the current standard for 8-hour ozone? How many violations have we had this year, for example?
Well, the current standard, we had 99 violations last year. That's the 75 parts per billion. But you have to be careful when you talk about what is the current standard, because, you know, every 5 years EPA establishes a new standard, and right now there are three standards that we're working to meet as we speak, even without the absent the new standard that is being put together. We have the one-hour ozone standard, which has been in effect, you know, since the late 1970s, and we're just about to meet that standard. In fact, we think we have met that standard in the last 2 years. We had zero violations of that one-hour ozone standard. And then there is the 84 parts per billion ozone standard, which we are also defined as an extreme non-attainment with a deadline of 2023 to meet that standard. And then 75 parts per billion, which is the one that we had 99 violations. The deadline for that is 2032, and then just 5 years after that, we would have to meet this new standard. So it's a complicated maze of redundant and duplicative requirements that we're trying to work our way through.
Has the EPA signed off on the one-hour standard? This is the one where your air district says that the Valley has met the one-hour standard now. You want that penalty lifted, essentially, for meeting that. But what you're saying, essentially, is that you like the EPA to write off one particular instance of an exceedance in Fresno as an exceptional event. Have they agreed to do that yet?
No, they have not. We did send a request to them earlier this year with respect to that. Now that we had another clean summer season, relatively speaking, where we had no violations, where EPA no longer has to make that finding of excluding that 1 hour, we are resubmitting a new request to them based on the 2014 summer data, which then makes that decision, in our view, easier by EPA, in that they don't have to exclude any of the so-called exceptional events that, as we referred to them, and we were hoping that this year, with this new request, in the next few months, EPA would be able to render a decision based on the latest information that we have finally met the one-hour ozone standard and not waste a lot of resources on, you know, on the old standard that could be really spent on meeting these tougher new standards moving forward.
Yeah. You said earlier that one of the problems with the Clean Air Act is it gives not enough time for your district to try to meet these goals. There are people out there in the activist community who say that it gives too much time, that there are people who right now in the Valley are suffering health consequences and premature deaths because of the pollution that we breathe each and every day. Why not try to speed things up? You mentioned fossil fuel emissions. Couldn't the Air District do something like banning driving on certain days or certain quotas for driving? That is admittedly a very drastic solution. There are some people who are calling for that, though. How do you respond to those?
Yeah, well, we definitely respect those viewpoints. But if you look at a region like San Joaquin Valley that suffers from, you know, chronic double-digit unemployment, you know, low income, poverty, and, you know, education level, I think you have to take that into account in how you balance, you know, what you do for clean air versus economy. The fact of the matter is that in our district, despite being in a conservative region, the regulations that we have already imposed on businesses and on even on people in your home now with your fireplaces and what you can do with your water heater and things like that, they're the toughest regulations that are in place anywhere. In fact, our regulations are often more stringent than even South Coast and other areas. So it's not lack of action or not wanting to expedite things, but basically what the point that we have reached at this point, even if money were no object, technology does not exist to meet the standards at this point. That's why, you know, the region, our region and South Coast, we were both designated as extreme non-attainment, which means you have a black box of reductions that you know you need, but you cannot find the technology to get there. Now, to ban driving, like, you know, we had 99 violations last year. So if someone suggests that for 99 days we should ban driving in San Joaquin Valley, and if that's seen as something that's practical and doable, I think that could be honestly and objectively questioned by some. You know, it's not like, you know, 1 day or 2 days here would get us there. You know, we're still quite a distance away from meeting the latest standard.
I understand the Air District is also having a conference early next year to talk about this ozone pollution issue and where some of the valley's ozone might be coming from. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Yeah, and we have to be careful when we talk about, you know, ozone or pollution transport from other regions to the valley, because sometimes people want to just say this is not a problem that we have to worry about, and, you know, this is just Bay Area's pollution or China pollution coming here, and we have to be careful to make sure people understand that we do have a lot of homegrown pollution that we have to take responsibility for and reduce. And, but when you have these tight standards that approach the background ozone level, every ounce of emission counts. So the pollution that's coming from Bay Area, the pollution that's coming from China, we have to make sure we identify, quantify those, and put some pressure on those areas, you know, Bay Area, and then through some national efforts on China to do their part by reducing their air pollution, you know, when they have coal power plants going, you know, blockbusters in China. And here we're telling people, you know, what kind of a deodorant you can use to cut air pollution, or don't use your fireplace, or and things, you know, a small dry cleaner service station. I think it's important to quantify the pollutant that comes from China. And at the end of the day, what we're hoping is that if we can show that this region has done everything that it can do under its regulatory authority and under its economic wherewithal, what we can do, if we have already put in place all the tough measures, the region, our region, should not be penalized for things that we have no control over, pollution from Bay Area, pollution from China. And this conference, we were inviting a host of experts from around the nation, including NASA and others that have studied the transboundary air pollution from China, to really come up with ways to accurately quantify that and then begin the policy discussions of how to deal with pollution that comes from other regions to our area.
We've been talking with Syed Sadreddin, the executive director of the Valley Air District, about the proposed new, more stringent EPA rules about ozone pollution in our air. Mr. Sadreddin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and find out about a new nature preserve that's opening to the public in just a few months in Tulare County. That's coming up on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. Central California is home to some of the state's most beautiful areas, from Yosemite Valley to High Sierra Lakes to rolling foothills. Lovers of that last topography have something to cheer about this winter, as a new nature preserve in Tulare County is set to open to the public in 2015. It's called the Blue Oak Ranch, and here to tell us more is Ann Huber of the Sequoia Riverlands Trust. Ann, tell us about this Blue Oak Ranch property. This is something that I understand the trust has had for a while, but you're getting ready to provide some public access in 2015.
Yeah, we're really excited to be able to turn our attention to raising funds for an on-site caretaker, which will allow us to open it on a regular basis to the public. And before we can do that, we have a number of volunteers that have agreed to at least open it one day a month, and we'll be able to do that in a few months with the help of local community members and members of the Porterville Unified School District.
So tell me about this property. Where is it? What's it like?
It's in the town of Springville. It's over 1,100 acres. It's mostly blue oak woodland, but it also has a number of other habitats. It has a really wide elevation range, which allows it to have a diverse community of plants and animals. And so it ranges from streams to wetlands to grassland to chaparral. It ranges in elevation from 1,700 feet to 2,700 feet. And it's nested right at the base of larger protected areas of the Giant Sequoia National Monument, National Forest, and Sequoia National Park. And so it really allows for an extension of that protected habitat into the Sierra Nevada foothills.
Has there been restoration work that you've had to do, habitat conservation? What's sort of that picture like in terms of the property getting it ready for to be a good ecosystem for the native species there?
Yeah, so since we acquired the property in 2005, we have done a number of restoration projects. And One of the things that we've done is preserved the working landscape nature of it. So we have cattle that are grazing on the land, and we use that as a management tool to control invasive species and reduce fire hazard. We also have a number of plant restoration projects along these corridors and have excluded cattle from the creeks. And we actually have a planting day that's coming up on December 20th, which is open to the public, to plant these native species along the creeks to provide better habitat for birds and for animals. It'll be an ongoing process of controlling invasive species and promoting native plants and habitat for animals and plants.
You mentioned that you will have that event on December 20th. You had an event recently that sort of kicked off this new public phase of the preserve. Tell me about the response on that day.
Okay. So, yeah, we were really excited about that. We have an education department that has partnered with the Porterville Union Unified School District's Environmental Sciences Academy. And so that's part of a program called Pathways to Linked Learning. And so students in the Environmental Science Academy have really adopted the Blue Oak Preserve. And so they took on that day to give tours, to give nature walks to the members of the public. They also recently helped us plant native species along one of our creeks. Last summer, they designed trails for the preserve. And so we're excited about continuing that relationship with them. We also have an archery range on the preserve that is managed by the Springville Archery Club and a couple of equestrian groups that have horseback rides on the preserve.
Now, this is not the only nature preserve that your organization manages. You also have, of course, the Cahuilla Oaks Preserve and some other things. Tell me about your other properties that you manage in Tulare County.
Yeah, so we have six preserves in total. Only half of those right now are open to the public on a regular basis, and that's because we need an on-site caretaker really for safety reasons. And so the ones that are open to the public, the best well-known, as you said, is the Cahuilla Oaks Preserve, which is in Exeter, just outside of Visalia. And then the other two are the Dry Creek Preserve and the Homer Ranch Preserve, and those are both in the Lemon Cove area. And then besides those, we have the Blue Oak Ranch, the James Herbert Wetland Prairie Preserve, which is in Farmersville, and the Lewis Hill Preserve, which is just north of Porterville. And that preserve supports habitat for two rare plant species.
So why is all of this important? Why go to the trouble of preserving this area of the valley? You know, Springville is a beautiful part of the country, beautiful part of Tulare County. But I know also in the Yokel Valley area, there's been a lot of talk about development and things. Is that part of the idea, preserve what we have now? Why is this important?
Okay, so most of the conserved property in Tulare County belongs to the national forests and the national parks, and those are higher elevation areas that may be more difficult for people to get to, and so most of the foothill areas really are in private ownership and in cattle ranches, and so it actually supports a really diverse assemblage of plants and animals. And it's becoming more and more difficult for cattle ranchers to make a living, and they have more pressure on developing. And so, you know, we support houses, but we also support the ability, and we'd like to provide opportunity and help people have access to these open spaces and to have formative experiences in nature that are closer to home. And also maybe not as expensive to get into. And so the Blue Oak Ranch Preserve is especially special because in the Springville area, that whole area is really has a low density of housing. And so it has a number of ranches. And between the close proximity to the higher elevation Sequoia National Park and National Forest, it also has nearby properties that are protected through conservation measures, through easements that we've helped landowners help put on their ranches to remain working landscapes. And also the Tulare County Office of Education has the Circle J Ranch and SICON. And so together we've been able to conserve about 5,000 acres in the Springville area.
Well, you mentioned that you're using cattle on the property now to help maintain the property. It seems like there's a lot more cooperation now between cattle ranchers or environmental organizations like your own and the ranching community. Is that a new development?
Maybe in certain circles it is.
Is there a synergy there?
I've been working in this field for over 20 years, and we've always had a research and management approach to different things like grazing. So it's really just another tool, and it really depends on different factors like timing and duration and just using it in an appropriate way for your goals. And if your goal is to manage the landscape for native species, then it's a great way to do so.
And if people want more information about all of your preserves and your organization, where can they go and tell us again about that event?
Yeah, so they can go to our website at www.sequoiariverlands.org. And on the website, there's a link that they can join and become a member. They can also donate online to help us raise funds for the ability to have a caretaker on site to the Blue Oak Ranch Preserve, or become a member and get on our newsletter list and be notified of volunteer activities such as the one that we have coming up on December 20th at the Blue Oak Ranch Preserve in Springville.
We've been talking with Ann Huber of the Sequoia Riverlands Trust. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us talk@kvpr.org and follow us on Twitter. We're at KVPR and at Valley Edition. For Valley Edition, producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporter Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.